Good morning. I don't know about you, but it takes me a week or two to adjust to time. I don't care which way we're going. I'm tired. Welcome to everyone. We always say that everyone is welcome here, of almost whatever theological persuasion. If your theological persuasion is hate, I'll probably tell you you're not in the right place. Welcome, no matter what your color, your ethnicity, your sexual orientation, and welcome to a place where we continually try to take one more step to build the just community. If this is your first time here, or one of your first times here, there'll be a chance later on in the program to tell us who you are. If you want to do that, we don't force anybody to get up. But I do encourage you to come to more than one service because our services vary greatly. Sometimes they are led by me, the minister, sometimes by people in the congregation, sometimes by people in the larger community. So come more than once, come back often. These then are the opening words written by Bill Scholes, a name some of you will recognize. He was our president of the Unitarian Universalist Association a few years ago. This is the mission of our faith, to teach the fragile art of hospitality, to revere both the critical mind and the generous heart, to prove that diversity need not mean divisiveness, and to witness to all that we must hold the whole world in our hands. We light the chalice this morning in celebration of the returning light. The sun is even out. And of the spring equinox that will occur this week. In the words of Diane Lee Mumy, again did the earth shift. Again did the nights grow short and the days long. And the people of the earth were glad and celebrated, each in their own ways. Perhaps the most we can hope for, and I use the word hope very intentionally, in the struggle to live in a world with evil in it, is to learn how to keep it at bay. And we do this in many ways. We do it with words, with patience, with hope, love, humor, and with stories. And by taking very good care of our children and our young people so that they will grow up to be strong, caring adults with a strong sense of good and evil. So I give you now a story. A story about hope in the midst of evil, and as always, invite the children or anyone of whatever age to come up and hear the story. I see some of us have our green on, huh? Whether we're Irish or not. Although I am, a little bit. So, this is a story about two 10-year-old girls who lost their homes. So it's a sad story in some ways, but it's a happy, hopeful story in other ways. And they lost their homes because they lived in a part of the world where there were wars going on and lots of fighting. And they just couldn't live in their homes. So they had to go to something called a refugee camp. Do you know what a refugee is? Oh, do you want me to give you my short version and see if you agree with it? You can sit wherever you'd like. Would you like to sit right? Oh, perfect. A refugee is someone who has lost their home, and not because they wanted to, like who wants to lose their home, but usually because other people were doing not nice things. I don't know if any of you would know this story. It's a really new book. 4 Feet, 2 Sandals. And it's a story of, as I said, two little girls. One of them's named Lena. So they're in the camp. And usually people in refugee camps live in tents. But it's not like fun camping. because people are very, very crowded and the tents often leak, and sometimes it's really hot where they are and sometimes it's cold. But people from all over the world send clothing and shoes and things like that to people who are in refugee camps. I'll bet there are people in this room right now who have done that. And so when the trucks come with the things that people, because people leave their homes to go into these camps, and they don't have anything with them usually except what they are wearing. And they're usually like, here and here when in bare feet. And I mean, there often are. And, you know, they might have a little suitcase or a paper bag or something. So when the trucks come with lots of stuff in, everybody rushes up to find something. Well, Lena's 10, so she's not real tall. I'm a little older than 10, and I'm not real tall either. But she didn't have much of a chance to get up there at the beginning. So everybody rushed up to get things, and she found one sandal. One brand new, clean sandal. And so, of course, she looked around to find the other one, but she didn't find it on the ground. The other sandal was on the foot of the other 10-year-old girl. They don't know each other at all. And the other little girl's name, we don't know yet. And Lena, though, says, As-salamu alaikum to her. My apologies to anybody who might speak Arabic. Peace be with you. Next day, Lena goes down to wash some clothes. They don't have washing machines. They have to use the river, if there is a river, or whatever water they can find. And she's being very careful not to get her brand new, wonderful sandal wet. So she's walking around with one sandal on. Just one. She only had one. And oh, that's what I think we're going to find out, what they do. And there comes the other girl down to the same river, down to the same spot, with her sandal on, and she introduces herself finally. She says, I am Feroza. And so Feroza hands her sandal to Lena, because Feroza's grandmother said, it is really silly to wear just one sandal. And she gave Lena the sandal, and she started to leave, and Lena said, wait, we can share. And Feroza said, how can we share? We'll take turns. Tomorrow will be your turn. So that's what they did for a long time. Every other day you had the sandal, both sandals. Well, they got to be very, very good friends. They got to be such good friends that they would sit around and talk a lot, because that's what good friends do. And they told their very sad stories. Lena's father and her two sisters were killed in the war. And that was just her mother and her two brothers left. And Feroza had no one left except her grandmother. And they really wanted to go to school. Well, it was hard to have schools. I know this might sound funny to some of you that they really wanted to go to school. It was, when you don't have something, that's when you really want it. But first of all, there often aren't schools in the camps. But secondly, in this part of the world, the schools were only for boys. So Feroza and Lena listened in at the window and did their lessons outside in the sand. And at night they'd talk about wanting to go to America or to Canada or to someplace. And they were all on lists to go to places. So eventually, hopefully, they would be able to go somewhere else and find a new house and get new clothes and everything. Well, one morning when Lena and Feroza were down at the stream at the river, Feroza's grandmother waved at them and said, Lena, come, your mother says your names have gotten to the top of the list, which means they got to leave the camps and they were going to America. But Feroza's name and her grandma's names weren't on the list, so of course it was very, very sad. Now, what to do about the sandals? Feroza said, you have to take the sandals to America. You can't go to America without anything on your feet. But Lena's mother had managed to save up enough money to buy Lena a pair of shoes. So first Feroza gives the sandals to Lena to wear to America, and then Lena gives them back to Feroza because her mother had bought her shoes. Well, it came time to get on the bus to start the journey to America. And Feroza and Lena were sad because it's always sad to say goodbye to your good friends. Feroza came running up to Lena as she was getting on the bus and said, wait, you have to keep one sandal. And Lena said, well, what good is one sandal? And Feroza said, it is good to remember. 4 feet, 2 sandals. And Lena got on the bus, and they all had tears in their eyes. And I think I'm getting tears in my eyes. And Feroza ran alongside the bus for as long as she could. And Lena leaned out the window and said, we will see each other again in America. So I guess we could write the next part of the story, huh? And see if they met. We can write a story about them meeting in America and what they did then to help other people who lived in the camps. Okay. See you next time I see you. Farewell. Good friends, farewell, good friends, farewell, farewell, till we meet again, farewell. I'd like to read you a few words that Kathleen Norris wrote. Some of you may be familiar with Kathleen Norris. She's obviously a writer, primarily a poet, has wrestled for years with the language of Christianity, although she would still call herself a Christian, I'm sure, and I know that many of you in this room wrestle with that. We've had interesting email exchanges about the word worship lately. I think some morning we'll just do a whole service on worship. That doesn't mean we'll be worshiping. Norris writes, in her section called Good and Evil from her book Amazing Grace. Most of the time, people will not come out and say that they are good people in contrast to those who are not, but that is often what they mean. And this strikes me as a dangerous proposition. History demonstrates repeatedly that if enough people begin to define themselves as good in contrast to others who are, in quotes, bad, those others come to be seen as less than human. Genocide is justified in the eyes of those who perpetrate it on the grounds that it is not real people who are being killed. Rather, something evil is being eliminated from the world by those who are good. I prefer the perspective of the Roman poet Terence, writes Norris, who wrote, I am human. I do not think of any human being, of any human thing as foreign to me. Norris says, I feel that it is my business when I read the news account of some horrible crime, not to regard my good self as completely separate from the bad people depicted in the story, but to search my own heart for a connection. I try to see if I can understand how it is these people have done what they have done. But some crimes are so evil that they defy belief. Think of Timothy McVeigh scouting the federal building in Oklahoma City and then taking care to place the bomb near the daycare center. Think of Jeffrey Dahmer cannibalizing the men he has murdered and storing their hearts in his refrigerator. Crimes in which basic human trust has been so heinously abused provoke a panicky response in us. We retreat back to the safety of friends and family, those whom we know, like a child pulling the covers up to keep at bay the monsters under the bed. We hide behind the mask of the self and say, I'm a good person. Norris says, I don't believe that I could hate anyone or anything enough to blow up a building without the slightest regard who happened to be inside, to who happened to be inside. Only ideology can hate that thoroughly. Frustration at bureaucrats I can understand, she says, but not the killing. When it comes to the crimes of Jeffrey Dahmer, however, I can understand them. All too well, she says. I am not quite sure why his story caught my attention. It may have been because a policeman said that Dahmer had seemed so enormously relieved to have been caught. The photographs in the news did not depict someone who was belligerent or boastful, as serial murderers often are. He seemed bewildered, exhausted, a lost soul. She then goes on to write about meeting a little boy who lived in a terrible home life setting. And Norris, of course, is afraid someday she'll be reading about him on the news. And at the end of that anecdote, she says, "I believe Jeffrey Dahmer shows us what the fear of abandonment can do to the human spirit. To judge by one survivor's account, a man who met Dahmer in a bar and had gone to his apartment, it was when he decided to leave after only one drink that Dahmer seemed to panic. This man got out. Others were not so fortunate. Apparently, it was the thought of being alone again, of having the person leave his life, that prompted Dahmer to go over the edge and begin drugging the drinks so that these men would stay forever. What seems saddest to me, says North, about the loss of human lives is that it might have been prevented. Dahmer had known for some time that something was wrong, and he had sought help. Several times he had turned to a church, and that seemed to allay the madness for a time, but it did not hold. Norris says, it is my firm conviction that some people may more readily be reached, changed, and even healed through, the word she uses, of course, is religious means, than through psychiatry. She says, I am one of them. However, she says, in the end, she doesn't know what to do except maybe pray. She puts it, I don't know much about how to deal with my own evil, and she goes into that in this section, but I have learned enough to recognize that sometimes all I can do is pray. As a humanist, I don't do much, if any, praying, at least not in the traditional sense. But I found myself relating to Norris's sentence about having learned enough to recognize that sometimes, when considering evil, all I can do is pray. Well, the more I delved into this subject of evil, the more ignorant I felt about it, the more overwhelmed and at a loss to make any sense of it. I do believe that each of us is born with the capacity for good and the capacity for evil. But I'm not even sure what I mean by that anymore. I'm also pretty sure that we won't probably be able to take care of the entire problem of evil this morning, so there may be a part two somewhere down the road. What exactly is evil? Do you know anyone who is evil? I mean, personally, do you know anyone? I'm not talking about political figures here, current or historical, but in your life now, or in the past, do you actually know anyone whom you would label or describe as evil? Evil takes different forms in different generations and in different cultures. My dad would have acknowledged the presence of evil in the world, I think. He fought and was wounded twice in World War II. He believed he was fighting a good fight. So maybe a necessary evil? A fight to rid the world of the evil Hitler personified. Writer and professor Lance Morrow, in his excellent, elegant book, Evil, An Investigation, says that people's views of evil tend to be generational, formed by particulars of personal and historical experience. The 60s rebellion against authority, says Morrow, introduced the idea of Satan as rock star. I am inclined, Morrow says, to refer in a more conventional way to Auschwitz. This fascinated me. I consider myself to be a child of the 60s, and yet I always end up at Auschwitz when I'm contemplating evil. After reading Lance Morrow's book, I am inclined to agree with him, though, on this one thing. It is ultimately not possible to understand evil. That doesn't mean it isn't real. That doesn't mean we should stop having a conversation with it. What does it mean? Unitarian Universalists have often been accused of ignoring or downplaying evil, of having a Sesame Street conception of evil. I don't think we're the only ones who are guilty of this. The very culture we live in doesn't acknowledge evil. Not really. At least we didn't before September 11th. We tend to gloss over it. Morrow says that America never accepted evil as part of its deeper theological scheme. The nation was founded under divine sponsorship, and whatever evils attended the American unfolding, for example, slavery, extermination of Indians, did not permanently stain that essential virtue. The American idea is to leave the damage behind and not look back. Every evil will be transcended as the nation goes on reinventing itself in better and more prosperous ways. Evils are disposable. I think there are many reasons why we in this country tend to ignore or avoid the subject of evil. For one thing, we are, most of us, really comfortable. Who wants to dwell upon the horrors of what happened in Newtown, Connecticut, in December? Who wants to think much about the evil of the AIDS epidemic in Africa? Who wants to pay attention to the huge number of refugees like Lena and Feroza pouring out of Syria, let alone all the many, many other refugees in the world? I think we have way too many examples of evil in our newspapers and on TV and in our sources of information. That may sound a little bit the opposite of what I just said, but I think because of all this evil that's always supposedly in the papers, we have become oblivious and or desensitized and or indifferent from too much evil, if there can be such a thing. Mark Twain writes about the evil of slave catchers and the cruelty of overseers, but far worse, Twain writes about the vast, smug unknowingness, the evil obliviousness of seemingly innocent people. This is something that has always puzzled me about the Holocaust. Why did good people step aside? They didn't step aside. Rosemary, I know you're going to want to say something because you live through this. But it happens everywhere that we step aside when we see evil for a number of reasons. But remember in Huckleberry Finn, when Tom gets off the steamboat downriver and reports that there was an accident on the boat? A boiler exploded. A woman asks, "Anyone hurt?" Tom answers, "No, ma'am, a couple of niggers killed." The woman replies, "Oh, thank heavens, because you know sometimes people do get hurt." This is an evil kind of innocence, the ignorant innocence of the powerful. And we're powerful, we people in this room. We're powerful. Morrow maintains, and I agree, that this theme runs through the American story. Evil, to me, is found anytime someone is diminished, somehow prevented from fulfilling their human potential. This diminishment can take many forms: verbal abuse, discrimination, rape, murder, to name a few. And notice how violence seems to be an underlying theme here. Perhaps violence provides the underpinning, the support structure for evil. Another way to say this is that for me, evil occurs anytime our first principle is violated, anytime that a person's inherent worth and dignity is trampled upon or ignored. And evil, from my perspective, occurs anytime there is a violation of our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. 900 dolphins were slaughtered a few weeks ago in the Solomon Islands because of a dispute between some villagers and of all things, an environmental group. That's evil. That's a lot of evil. And we're all busy doing it, doing evil by my definition and description of what I think evil is. So does my take on evil need to be refined? Am I going down a slippery slope, casting such a broad net for evil doing? What about necessary evils? Morrow says that maybe we need the word evil in our vocabulary because it is necessary to human community. It indicates what we collectively will not tolerate. Back to my dad and a story that Lance Morrow tells in his book. I never asked my dad if he killed anyone when he was a soldier in France and then Germany in World War II, but it seems to me he must have. I would like to know how that felt. I would like to know if he thought the killing he must have done was evil. Lance Morrow tells a story about a rifleman in World War II, someone like my father. This particular rifleman was a rifleman toward the end of World War II, and his squad was moving out in advance of the American lines into no man's land, exactly what my dad's squad was doing. They came to a small river and they captured 8 Germans there. These Germans were little more than kids, 16 or 17 years old. What to do with them? The Americans were far from their lines. They couldn't take them prisoner. The country was too dangerous and they had their assignment, and they could not let them go. What do you think the Americans did with those young German soldiers? They shot and killed them. It struck me when reading this story that it is not too far-fetched to imagine that if the Americans had let these particular Germans go, they might have gone on to kill my dad, who was in the same vicinity, separated from his unit. Was this evil, killing the German soldiers? Were these evil deeds? That rifleman who did the killing became an extremely productive member of society. He inherited lots of money, and during his lifetime he gave away considerable amounts of money to education and to the arts. He had wonderful productive children and then presumably wonderful productive grandchildren. This man, this rifleman, was a professor who taught thousands of students and influenced thousands of lives. Necessary evils, maybe. Here's a true story about a hermit, a story that Lance Morrow says is maybe a story of micro evil, or maybe not even that, but a near miss, an either or. This hermit lived in a deer hunter's windowless cinder block cabin in the woods in upstate New York, half a mile from Lance Morrow and his family, across from an old gravel pit, important to the story. The gravel pit. No one ever spoke to this man, and he never spoke to anyone, ever. A neighbor had lived there for 50 years and didn't even know the man's name, where he came from, what he did for a living. The hermit drove by the Morrow's house every morning at exactly the same time. He always drove 40 miles per hour. He never looked to the right or the left, straight ahead. The Morrow's dog, Fred, would often shy on the road past the hermit's house. People weren't so much afraid of the hermit, though, as curious. One winter day, Lance Morrow and his wife saw the hermit making snow angels in the snow. And one fall day, a tow truck came and took the two junky cars from in front of the hermit's house, and then a day shortly after that, another truck came along, and they're bringing an old but well-washed, in good condition, Plymouth. And all day, that day, the hermit drove that new car back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then he died at the wheel of that Plymouth, soon after he had washed and even waxed it. The hermit died by rigging a hose from the exhaust pipe to the front vent window. When going through his belongings, the police found cancer medication. Eventually, someone bought the hermit's cabin and began gutting it. When the new owner tore up the floorboards, he made a discovery. Arranged in secret compartments beneath the boards, he found dozens of little girl dolls of various styles and vintages collected over many years. The dresses on the dolls were torn or cut below the waist. the genital areas were mutilated, gouged, or scissored. There were no crimes on record involving this hermit. Apparently, the hermit had just been engaging in weirdness. There was nothing in the gravel pit. But what a possibility. Was this evil? Or is this a story of evil resisted with great cost, great struggle over a period of years? As far as could be determined, that hermit did not touch little girls. Was he evil? Compare this to the exposure of sexually abusive priests. Metaphorically speaking, some floorboards of the church were taken up, and in these secret compartments revealed, there were secrets more evil than those of the hermit in his hunter's cabin. What is evil? Is there a global standard of evil? Well, I personally think there should be, if for no other reason than the weapons we now have both a global range and the capability to destroy all human life. As Albert Einstein said, and I'm so fond of quoting, everything has changed except our way of thinking. And here's an equally moving, beautiful quote from Morrow's book about evil. The global development of our technology and weapons exceeds the speed of our moral development as a planet. The result is planetary regression, and that, to my mind, is evil big time. Morrow writes that the real struggle in the world may not be between good and evil, but between hope and evil. Hope seems more active and creative than the somewhat wishy-washy, nebulous word good. Maybe the opposite of evil is not good then, but hope. Evil is energetic and needs to be countered or opposed with something more vigorous than good. Good is much less interesting than Lucifer or Satan. Good is blandly undramatic, a sort of, and Lance Morrow says this in his book, a sort of Unitarian vanilla. Hope, though, hope is goodness in a tight spot, ambitious to improve things. One more story about evil. It concerns a woman named Pumla Goboto Madikizela. And again, I apologize if there's anyone here who speaks South African languages fluently. Pumla, a black South African psychologist who served on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was formed in South Africa after the official end of apartheid in 1994. It's the TRC. In the mid-1990s, she interviewed Eugene de Kock, the commander of the state-sanctioned apartheid death squads. Eventually, he asked to see the widows of several black policemen he had executed at a place called Motherwell, which some of you will remember that name. De Kock wanted to apologize. Two widows met with him. He was remorseful. He wept. Ms. Goboto Madikizela found that she was troubled by many questions that came up for her during this meeting. Was de Kock deserving of the forgiveness shown him by the widows? Was he too evil to be forgiven? A question posed by T.S. Eliot kept recurring in her thoughts. After such knowledge, what forgiveness? It recurs in my mind, too, with the whole Catholic cover-up. One day, Goboto Madikizela was so moved by de Kock's pain and remorse that she reached out and touched his shaking hand, surprising herself, she said. Both parties were startled by this gesture. A black woman in authority touched a white man in chains. A black presumed to comfort the former white master. Quite a role reversal. Good put its hand on evil's hand, just for a moment. Goboto Madikizela was appalled. Did this mean she had bestowed a sort of blessing on that evil hand, on that evil man? Did she even have the right to do that? Did this make her somehow complicit in his evil deeds? She was struggling with that whole issue of identifying with the evil person. And she thought, does that matter? Because he, this evil person, was obviously struggling with what he had done in the past. And that is what Gobodo Madikizela decided mattered the most. How do we resist evil? How do we confront evil? As of March 6th, there were 1 million Syrian refugees, and half of them are children. How do we give them hope? I give $10 a month. Such a whopping amount. 10 lousy dollars a month. To the United Nations High Refugees Commission. Does it give anyone hope? I don't know. I do know that 3,600 so-called lost boys of the Sudan resettled in United States cities with the help of the UNHRC in 2001. And that one named Jacob Atem, recently returned to the South Sudan and opened a clinic in his home village there. Rely on hope. Rely on love. Rely on patience. Rely on the words and the stories of people like Pumala Gobodo Madikizela and the people like that American rifleman. Rely on the knowledge that good can overcome evil. Remember the story of the hermit, and rely on compassion as you go out into the world and encounter evil, because you will encounter.
Let us go forth into the world through a door of hope. Hope for the future. Remembering these words by Martin Luther. Not Martin Luther King. Even if I knew that tomorrow the world would go to pieces, I would still plant my apple tree. Go in peace.